Welcome to this special program featuring a presentation from the 2014 Camden Conference. I'm Jim Campbell. The theme of the 27th Annual Camden Conference, which was held from February 21st to 23rd, 2014, in Camden, Maine, was The Global Politics of Food and Water. It's no secret that we're facing enormous challenges to our planet in the coming years, and the conference addressed two of them: the need to be able to feed a rapidly expanding population, and the need to adjust to enormous changes to our water resources. Senator George Mitchell provided a short summary of those challenges in taped comments that opened the conference.
Over the next several decades, we in the United States and people around the world will face daunting challenges. Population growth, demands on natural resources, economic growth, other problems really spanning the globe. Think about the fact that it took 1,800 years following the birth of Christ for the Earth's population to reach 1 billion. The most recent billion, the seventh, took less than 15 years. The United Nations' recent projections suggest that by the middle of this century, just a few decades away, the population will reach about 9.5 billion people. The demands on natural resources, on land, on water, all other forms, will grow dramatically. And at the same time, science is telling us clearly that actions by human beings are affecting the climate of the Earth. Threats that arise from that, of course, represent challenges to every society and indeed to coastal areas. Right where you're sitting in Camden, there might be an increase in sea level by a large margin, which would threaten life as we know it along the Atlantic seaboard and in coastal communities around the world. I know you're going to hear from a number of experts in these and other areas. I know that you and the audience will be challenged, and I hope will participate. And I'm certain that you, as I have in the past, will enjoy the experience of the Camden Conference. Thank you. Have a great evening and a great weekend.
Senator Mitchell's comments served as a framework for the conference's concerns. He mentioned climate change, and one of the speakers who spoke directly to the effect that climate change will have on water resources, and thus on human beings, was Andrew Guzman. His presentation was entitled Overheating: The Human Cost of Climate Change, which is also the title of a book that he wrote on the subject. In his talk, he used a few slides as photographic illustrations, but those are not at all necessary to follow his presentation. Andrew Guzman was introduced by John Piotti, who served as conference moderator when Jonathan Foley, the scheduled moderator, was trapped in Minnesota by bad weather. John Piotti attended MIT, and this explains the references to the two schools in Cambridge, Massachusetts, MIT and Harvard, made by both Piotti and Guzman. Here is John Piotti.
Our next speaker is the author of this very well-received book, Overheated: The Human Cost of Climate Change. I'm sure he's going to speak about it in more detail, but a lot of books about climate change really take it from the scientific perspective, and this really talks about how it directly affects society and humans, and I'm really eager to hear more. He is a professor at law at the University of California at Berkeley. He's had an impressive academic background that was begun by receiving a couple of degrees from that other institution in Cambridge, Harvard. I won't hold that against him. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy Andrew Guzman.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me. I was going to go to the MIT law school, but they wouldn't even reply to my application. I'm here, I guess, because I wrote a book about climate change, and this is a conference about water and food. To most of you, that connection is not mysterious. But before I started working on the book, I don't think I would have appreciated how large the connection is. The book is, I don't know, 115,000 words or something like that. But if you really put a gun to my head, the one word I could get it down to is water. Of all the things climate change is going to do, its impact on the way on human beings and their relationship to water is going to change almost certainly more than anything else. So what I would like to do then is talk about three different ways in which climate change affects our water and how those changes to our water affect us. Because ultimately what I hope the book does is explains how human beings are going to be affected. I am of the view that if you want to change the views of policymakers, you have to change the views of the public. And if you want to change the views of the public on a large scale, you have to talk about people. It's not enough to talk about polar bears. It's not enough to talk about natural habitats. It's not enough to talk about the oceans. You need to talk about how people are affected. So that's the goal of the book. To get there, I need to do something about the science, because you need to say something about what climate change is or what the world's going to look like. And so my strategy is to adopt a fairly conservative estimate of how much our world is going to change, and in particular adopt an estimate about average global temperature change that is neither dramatic nor, I think, controversial in most scientific circles, and indeed has become less so in the few years since I started writing the book. The notion that global average temperatures will increase by 2 degrees Celsius by the end of this century is not certain. At least the IPCC reports are unwilling to say anything so strong. But certainly the best guess of the large majority of climate scientists would be that a number bigger than 2 degrees is what we have to look forward to. So this is conservative in that sense. What I'd like to do then is try to persuade you, and for many of you this won't be news, but hopefully the details or the specifics are worth repeating, to persuade you that this is a really big deal, that the human cost of this kind of a change is enormous. Enormous on a scale that human beings have not really faced in our history. And the way I want to measure that cost is in the most obvious way you can think of. It's also the most brutal way you can think of, and that's in terms of human lives. And what I want to persuade you of in this brief talk is that the scale we should be thinking of in terms of human lives lost, deaths due to climate change, is something like in the hundreds of millions. And the number of human lives materially harmed or quality of lives harmed is a larger number, something on the order of several billion people. So that's the thesis. And I'm actually going to start with the second number, the several billion. I think that's easier to demonstrate. Climate change is going to do a lot of things, but it turns out that I can get to this several billion number with only one consequence of climate change, and that's its effect on mountain glaciers or similar structures, snowpacks. Mountain glaciers are an incredible thing. They are massive water storage devices. Or maybe the incredible thing isn't so much the glaciers, but the human response to them. When humans decided to settle down into permanent communities 10 or 12,000 years ago, there are a few basic things you need for a human community, and one of them is water. And it turns out it's not good enough to have a daily average supply of water over the year that is adequate. You actually need the water every day. And so human beings needed to find places where they could get water every day. And one of the ways to do that was to settle near bodies of water, rivers, very often, where the water comes to you every day. And those rivers are often fed by mountain glaciers. So it shouldn't surprise us all that much that 10 or 12,000 years after we started this business of living in sedentary communities, the fact that, and given that we built the system on the idea of using mountain glaciers as our water storage devices, that if they fail, we're in big trouble. And failing is exactly what they're doing. But let me start small. Let me start with this community. This is a group of indigenous peoples in Bolivia called the Uruchipaya. They've been in Bolivia since long before Europeans arrived in Bolivia, long before it was Bolivia. They've been there for at least 4,000 years. And they settled there roughly where they are today along a river called the Lauca River. And this was a really good strategy, which is why they've been able to stay there ever since. The river fed by an Andean glacier has provided them with the water they need for all those millennia, notwithstanding all the other changes going around them. That run is now over. That is, the Uruchipaya themselves, authorities in Bolivia, others all agree that this is the last generation of Uruchipaya who are going to be able to live in the way they've been living in the past. The water, the River Lauca, is just no longer sufficient to support their way of life, even though there's not that many people involved. So within a generation, they are going to have to move. And a lot of euphemisms are used when talking about climate change when people are affected. I'll probably use some along the way. But move is what's going to happen to them. They're not going to die on the spot. They're going to move, but they're not going to move the way I moved to California when I got a job there. They're going to move the way displaced people move all over the world, which is with incredibly poor economic prospects, likely to cities where they'll try to eke out a living. And it's unlikely to go well for the vast majority of them. There's about 2,000 of these people. I'm pretty comfortable that their quality of life is going to be harmed. So of the 3.5 billion I promised you, I now have 2,000. So I'm going to have to pick up the pace a little bit. For the math inclined, that's 5/1,000ths of a percent. But it turns out it's not that hard to speed up. You don't have to go very far there in Bolivia. Bolivia is a mountainous region that relies on Andean glaciers, not so differently from the way the Uruchipaya do. The Uruchipaya are a great story for my purposes because it's basically a single river supplying a single, fairly small community. When you scale up to larger entities, though, the basic arithmetic of water is the same. We don't know how to make water in any meaningful quantity that is potable water. And so if we don't have enough, we just don't have enough. And that's Bolivia's reality. As the Andean glaciers retreat is the euphemism for that, for melting. The availability of water during the dry season will be impacted, and will be impacted in an important way, and it will affect the whole country. Two of the three largest cities in Bolivia receive 40% of their water from directly from Andean glaciers. With a population growing, it's a good question how they're going to manage that. That gets me to 10 million. If you just draw concentric, roughly speaking, don't bust me too badly on the geography here. If you draw concentric circles out, you get a similar story. I realize this isn't really concentric circles. But Peru, Ecuador, Chile, they all have similar geography and the exact same problem. The Andean glaciers that supply very large shares of their water are melting. It doesn't mean there'll be less water necessarily. It'll mean there'll be more water when they don't need it in the wet season and less water in the dry season. So I get to 71 million there. If Latin America seems far away, maybe this next place will seem far away to you as well, but it doesn't to me, and that's California. California is currently in a drought. We receive 35% of our, the drought we're in now is not the drought I'm about to talk about, but we receive 35% of our water from the Sierra snowpack. By 2050, that snowpack will have shrunk by somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 40%. Even if our population doesn't grow, which is an unrealistic assumption, we will have even more water crises than we have now. The 25 to 40% in fact understates that, because the reason smaller glaciers are a problem is twofold. One, they simply store less water. So in the winter, in the rainy season, less water is frozen in the glaciers, more runs down the mountains to us when we don't need it. Our reservoirs are full, our fields are wet, it ends up in the ocean. But there's another problem that's less obvious, which is the world's warmer. So the glaciers melt earlier, perhaps a month earlier by 2050. So the melt starts sooner when we, again, don't need it, and some of that early runoff ends up in the ocean. So we lose some more that way. To give a sense of scale, the second worst drought in the history of California was in 1977. In the history of California here, I mean about 150 years of history. The worst drought is the well-known winter of 2013-14. That's the worst drought in about 500 years. The 1977 drought, which is the one I've been using until this year, we can expect droughts like that. Instead of a once in 150-year event, which is what you could describe it as, it'll be a once in every 8-year event by 2050. By the end of the century, it'll come along as frequently as, say, the Winter Olympics. So I grew up in Canada. So the next time the Canadian men's and women's hockey teams win the gold medal will be roughly the same period of time I'm talking about. So, all right, I'm still a long way from billions, so I'm going to speed up. As the man once said, if you want to, when asked why he robbed bank, he said, that's where the money is. If you want to find a lot of people, you got to go where the people are, and that's Asia, 60% of the world's population. What I'd like to do, instead of telling the story of the Uruchipaya in Bolivia, the parts of South America, and the United States over again, is simply read off the names of some important rivers and then tell you the population that live in those river basins. All of these rivers are heavily fed by glaciers. All of them will, all those glaciers will be shrinking or are shrinking. Not literally everyone is shrinking now, but that's where they're all headed. And you'll see how quickly these numbers add up. So the Indus River has 178 million people in its basin. The Ganges River, 407. The Yangtze River, 369 million. The Yellow River, 147 million. The Brahmaputra River, 119 million. The Sirdam and Amu River, 41 million. And the last one I want to mention is a smaller one, the Tarim River, which has 8 million people. I save that one for last because it allows me to say a small number of people, 8 million. The scale on which this happens in climate change causes us to become numb to these numbers. If 8 million people were being affected by a bad thing, I could base an entire presentation on the fact that this is a serious problem. But the 8 million people here is a footnote. It's a rounding error. I claim that most of us don't see a difference between this number and this number. And I'm not done. That is, I've identified a whole bunch of places, but I could keep going. And if one were to keep going, the number you would get is something like this. Now, again, these numbers are big. They're hard to hold in our head. Human beings aren't very good at processing numbers of this scale, understanding their relative magnitude. Sometimes it's easier to think in proportions. Something like half the people in the world live in places where mountain glaciers are an important part of their water supply. All of those people face the prospect of water difficulties in the next 100 years, certainly 50 years for most of them. Some of these difficulties will be full-on crises. Some of them will be less than that, but they all face serious difficulties. I think that gets me my billions, but I'm a cautious fellow. In case that's not good enough, it turns out that there's a real correlation between where people live and where people work. And one of the things people do when they work is they grow food, as we've seen already. If half of the world's population is facing places that are water stressed, that's not good news for agricultural production. And that means that we will grow less food, and when we grow less food, we know what happens, food prices go up. That's how we distribute food on our planet. And we also know what that's going to mean. It means that for people who are wealthy, which is the large majority of Americans, that is wealthy on a global scale, we will experience higher food budgets, higher food costs, and we will think to ourselves, what a shame, I wish I didn't have to spend so much money on food. People who are middle class in a global sense, which is some small portion of the United States, much of the lower socioeconomic spectrum in the United States, those people will face difficult budgeting choices. They will have to choose between feeding their family, providing health care, providing shelter. They will be trading off bare necessities one against the other because food prices will go up. We've seen previews of this when food prices spike. 2008 comes to mind. That's our future. I have yet mentioned the poor in the world, of which there are very few in the United States, perhaps as few as none. The poor on a global scale won't have that problem. They won't have the problem of the middle class because they won't have anything to trade off. They simply won't be able to afford food. And we will see much wider starvation, much more frequent famine, and all the bad things that come with that. So that's the talk is really about water, but obviously the food implications come right along behind it. So that's mountain glaciers. That, I think, gets me my billions. I want to shift to talk about the hundreds of millions, that is, people killed by climate change. This portion of the talk is not quite as linear. It's not quite as clear cut. But I think it gets to the point. And I want to start with a different phenomenon that's going to happen with water, and that's rising seas. If you go to any talk on climate change, including this one, and you hear the words rising seas, it is only a matter of a sentence or two before you hear the word Bangladesh. Because Bangladesh is the poster child for rising seas. That's true for me, too. I'm using Bangladesh, and with good reason. It's incredibly vulnerable because of its geography, it's very populous, and it's very poor. That's a sort of triple whammy of rising seas you don't want. A reasonable estimate of sea rise in this century is about a meter. And that's consistent with this conservative 2 degrees Celsius increase in global average temperatures. For Bangladesh, that means lots of flooding, a loss of something like 17% of its land mass for habitation. So 17% consistent with the theme of humans aren't very good at numbers. What does that mean? Well, to put it in perspective, I want you to imagine the United States losing 17% of its land mass. The U.S. is not going to lose anything like that in this century, but as a thought experiment. So cast your mind back to your middle school geography. This is a map of the United States. What would 17% of this map look like? Well, you could start with a strip of land towards the east, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Ohio. That gets you part of the way there, but it doesn't actually get you all the way to 17%. You have to add a little bit more, which is the entire East Coast. So from here, you couldn't walk to land, right? You would need some kind of transportation. There's a West Coast version that you're not interested in. So what does that mean? I understand, you know, we live with that bias in California. What does that mean for Bangladesh then losing that much land? It turns out that the kind of flooding they'll get isn't all that lethal itself. Flooding, even in storms, doesn't kill huge numbers of people. People, by and large, are able to flee ahead of the flooding and escape storms without dying. The problem is they then get displaced. They become displaced people. And a little bit of vocabulary, we call them displaced people until they cross an international border, and then we call them refugees. Doesn't matter to them. So Bangladesh can expect something on the order of 20 million displaced people as the seas rise. Now, we have a way of dealing with displaced people or refugees that we've developed, honed in the 20th century when we made a lot of them, and that is the following. If we're doing a good job, that is, as a human community, we try to find a way for them to survive in camps, for example, so that we try to provide them with the least possible necessities for survival, and then we wait. And we wait for the conflict that created the refugees or the displaced people to go away, and then we hope that they'll be able to go home. This is actually not a terrible strategy for conflict, which is what the 20th century had lots of. It's a really bad strategy for rising seas, because the place they fled isn't coming back. So there is no home to go to. So the one strategy we have, I say it's good, it's actually terrible if it's measured in terms of how horrible it is for human beings. That one strategy, bad though it might be, doesn't work at all. So this group of displaced people, which is slightly larger than the total number of displaced people in the world today, slightly smaller than, I'm sorry, but just in Bangladesh, we don't have a strategy. And if you look outside of Bangladesh, there's no other country that is comparably affected. Bangladesh is by far the worst. But Bangladesh is just one country. If you add up all the other countries, it's very hard to get a good estimate, so give me lots of variance on this. But a reasonable estimate that is not outlandish is about 200 million people on the planet. Another big number, another way to think about this, about one in every 33 people on the planet. What do we do about that? A lot of people at this point might say, well, we don't know what's going to happen then. But I know what's going to happen then, or at least I know what's not going to happen then. Right? You may remember after the Vietnam War, there was a settlement of people from Cambodia, for example, in the United States, in Canada, and elsewhere. That's not going to happen. And I know it's not going to happen because the numbers are too big. Suppose you were in charge of resettling 200 million people. The first thing you would almost certainly do is you say, well, we can't distribute them in kind of proportional population around the world. It has to have something to do with GDP per capita or total GDP, because rich countries have so much more capacity to accept these people, to incorporate them into the society. If that was the guide, if GDP was the guide, the American share of this population is about 50 million people. My congressperson, Barbara Lee, is probably the most liberal congressperson in the United States Congress. I am pretty confident that Barbara Lee would not actually support 50 million people coming into the United States who are poor, in poor health, often don't speak English, not white, all of these things, right? I don't think there's any prospect of the United States opening its doors to this. And I don't think the United States is special. I think that's true of other countries too. In other words, what's going to happen to these 200 million people is nothing. They are going to be where they are. They're going to crowd into cities that are often already overcrowded. They may find themselves in camps. Being a refugee in a camp is a terrible way to live. You are preyed on by everybody, from other refugees to the guards to the people who live in the region who wish you weren't there. And lots of these people are going to die. I don't know how many will, but lots and lots will. So that's the first sort of issue with the killing by climate change, it won't actually be the flooding, it'll be the next stage. And that stage includes disease and hunger, as well as violence. Now I want to pivot to, so that's my second example. My third example, the final one, is Pakistan. And this is violence writ large. So Pakistan is a really arid country. It is a country that couldn't exist but for the presence of the Indus River running down the spine of the country. 90% of Pakistan's water comes from the Indus River. The Indus River made a prior appearance in this talk as one of the rivers fed by mountain glaciers. 80% of the river comes from mountain glaciers, more or less. By the end of the century, that flow from mountain glaciers in the dry season will be reduced by 30 to 40%. One other detail you need to know about this story is the Indus River, before it reaches Pakistan, passes through a country called India. India and Pakistan could not be described as close allies. India and Pakistan have fought four wars with each other, admittedly small wars with modest casualties, but four wars with each other since their mutual independence in 1947. There are already charges from Pakistan that India interferes with the water flow coming from the Indus River. I don't know if Pakistan's right on that one. India says no, Pakistan says yes. India has the ability to interfere with the water flow because India has carefully constructed a series of dams and other forms, other devices that will allow it to essentially turn the faucet on and off with Pakistan. And there's a treaty in place that purports to provide rules about how much water has to get through. That's where we are today, in a region where India routinely accuses Pakistan of terrorist acts and may or may not be right, and which Pakistan routinely accuses India of messing with its water supply. Now, constrict the water supply by 30 or 40%. It's not actually a constriction. This more or less the same amount of water is likely to come, but it'll all come in the wet season. So more floods in the wet season, more drought in the dry season. But you can think of it as just less water. What happens? Well, there's got to be less for everybody. And India controls the tap. So I promise you a couple things. I promise you Pakistan will get less water than it's getting now. And I promise you Pakistan will think it's being cheated. I don't know if it'll be cheated. I don't even know what it means to be cheated. There may not even be an agreement. India may just say, we'll give you whatever we want, and that's the end. So what do you do if you're Pakistan? Well, if you're Pakistan, you run through a kind of hierarchy of international efforts to affect another country, right? You send a diplomat to Delhi, and you say, let's work this out. But note the position this diplomat's in. The diplomat says to the Indian representative, his Indian counterpart, says, look, there's less water for everybody. Let's share the pain. To which the Indian replies, that sounds like a good solution for you. But why don't I just take as much water as I can? It's through my country first. That diplomacy may actually work, right? We solve lots of problems with diplomacy. It's conceivable we'll solve this one. But if it doesn't, what's plan B for the Pakistani delegate? Or at least if you go down the standard list of diplomacy, it's economic carrots and sticks. It turns out that Pakistan can't do that. Pakistan is poorer per capita, much poorer in absolute size. It just doesn't have an economic market that it can use to threaten India, either with carrots or with sort of economic sticks. Next on the list is real sticks, right? Military options. Pakistan runs into the same problem. Smaller military, less well-equipped, less wealthy. It can't attempt to compete with India in a serious way in a military confrontation, or at least not in a conventional military confrontation. What Pakistan has is nuclear weapons. India has them too. So, if the goal is to keep the water flowing, and if a failure to keep the water flowing means death for lots and lots of people in your country, perhaps death for the country itself, that is, it's not at all clear that Pakistan can exist as a state, as a functioning state, to whatever degree it functions now, without much of the water it gets. If that water supply gets dramatically cut, the state may collapse in the Somalian style. If that's your situation, and if the Indians aren't playing ball, what are you going to do? What did the Americans do in Europe when the Soviets had the ability to roll their tanks westward, and almost certainly without enough resistance to stop them? You threaten with the only weapon you've got. Now, the Pakistani government doesn't say this out loud, but you know who does is the Pakistani media. This is not an idle notion. This is not hypothetical in Pakistan. This is something that is in the papers. The message is clear. If we need to, this is not the government now, to be fair, it's the media and some private individuals, including former government officials. If we need to, we will use the nuclear threat to secure sufficient water from India. Now again, they may work this out, India and Pakistan may work this out, but they may not. And if they don't, they may or may not end up in a nuclear standoff. I'm not suggesting this is inevitable, I'm suggesting that this is a risk. And I'm suggesting it's not the only such risk. Another place you might see such a risk is Israel, with its neighbors, also very water-stressed. Another place you see risks of this sort, not nuclear, is Nigeria, where there's internal conflicts that could explode because of water stress. The point is on this sort of security dimension, all the areas in which there are existing tensions, in which there's an existing concern about conflict and violence, if you add the kind of vice of climate change to ratchet up the stress on water in particular, but then the consequential stress on crops and on other things, on power, the chances of violence go way up. This is what in security circles they call a risk amplifier. So take a problem you're already worried about and dial it to 11. And that's what we face. And the chances, you need an incredible sense of optimism to think all of these different places, when we roll the dice this way, we'll get the right numbers. We'll get lucky. We'll get lucky in India, in Israel, in Nigeria, and in all the other places you could think of. So in that sense, the likelihood that we see large-scale human death as a result is right there in front of us, because all these conflicts are going to become more likely to happen. And human history suggests that we get more than zero conflicts already. So if conflicts are more likely, we can expect more of them. That again, I haven't counted up to 300 million deaths, but you get the idea. I think we get there. And all of those are connected to climate change, not because people die from heat stroke, though some will do that, but because climate change sets us on a course where we have competition for resources or other kinds of interactions that cause massive human suffering, including death. This is all from a 2-degree increase. We could well do worse. All of these harms grow roughly exponentially with increases in temperature. In other words, the difference in harm from 1 to 2 degrees is much less than the difference in harm between 2 and 3 degrees. So if this number is low, the harms get much bigger very, very fast. The way I want to end this then, aside from that very optimistic note, is to remind us that there's two ways to view this kind of problem. One is to view it as we're in big trouble. Another to view it as a challenge. Humans have encountered challenges, not of this flavor in particular, but we've encountered challenges before. And when we overcome them, we rightly celebrate those achievements. So we celebrate the greatest generation for their confrontation with fascism. And rightly so. For a generation to which I belong to which the college students, I flatter myself by saying, belong to the same one as me. Let's stretch it a little bit. But to people who now or in the not too distant future will be influential in policy and collective decision making, this is our greatest challenge. This is the challenge we have to meet. If we do it, even though we can't stop climate change tomorrow, if we do it, the payoff we can think of in these terms. We will be saving literally hundreds of millions of lives in less than a century. And we will be materially improving the lives of billions of people, maybe every person on the planet as a rough approximation, if we manage to find ways to mitigate this threat. So I prefer to view it in those slightly more optimistic terms without in any way ignoring the magnitude of the threat. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. That was great.
Thanks.
Well, we appreciate it. Before we dive into questions, I've been asked to pass on another stage direction. We'd like the people who wish to ask questions to stand. That will make it a little easier for us to capture them on film. We're a little ahead of the mic holders. So in the back, Mic number one.
Hello, my name is Lila Percy, and a question about the politics of water in terms of in what happens if Coca-Cola needs water to make soda. We need water to for agriculture, and we need water to drink. So is that a part of the conversation currently? Because you've got the business part of it, and then you have the survival part of it. Could you address that, please?
So yes, it certainly is, and it's been for a long time in California, for example, among many other states of the U.S. and other parts of the world. I think of it in these terms. I use California as the example, though the same would apply in some form. You know, there's serious political fights in California about access to water. They're happening, you know, even on the weekend today, about agriculture versus urban centers versus environmentalists versus business, because there's just not enough water. The way you distribute the water that you have matters enormously. And that's absolutely true. And they're important policy decisions. And I teach in a law school. Some of the students I train will earn a pretty good living in Sacramento fighting over exactly this. My main interest, though, is not so much in how you slice up a fixed pie. My main concern is that the pie is shrinking. And as the pie shrinks, it's going to make all those competitions for the resource more acute. It may be that not everybody will lose, but a lot of more losers than winners. So I don't want to resist the notion that the distributional questions are really important. And we have an existing political system to resolve them that may or may not work well. However that works now, it's going to become more difficult going forward.
Going over to mic two.
Brian Strong, Fairfield, Connecticut. A question about your impression of the impact of some technologies. Obviously, the snow melt is a matter of, you know, storing. So, there must be some valleys we can flood to help with the storage issue and the timing issue. And then desalinization, I wonder about the economics of that. And then thirdly, as a bonus, would you comment on the Pakistanis taking out those hydro-atrocity sites with conventional weapons?
Let me try and see if I can do all three of those. Now I've lost track already. The Pakistani thing cleared my brain of everything else. In terms of technology, which I think was the second one. The first one, which is how do you store this water? And absolutely, if a lot of water is being lost into the ocean, which is what will happen in California and other places, efforts will be made to store it more effectively. The scale of that makes it impractical as a solution, but that doesn't mean it won't happen in the sense that more than nothing will be done. So if the problem is this big, our solution will make it smaller. Whether it'll make it this much smaller or that much smaller is difficult to say, but you're right. And you actually have a really good example, which is the easy way is say, well, why don't we build reservoirs? That clearly is not going to get us the scale. When we start flooding valleys, now you're talking, right? Now you're talking China's way of doing this. So you can do it, at least you would think you could do it. And then the question is, well, do you want to do that? What are the consequences of that? What are the economics and the politics of that? What are the other environmental consequences? There's a whole chain of bad things that could conceivably happen. But that's a question we're going to face. On the technology, I am no Luddite. I don't think technology let me rephrase that. I'm certain technology will be part of this solution. Desalinization is one version, but lots of other technologies, whether it's cloud seeding or reflecting sunlight or seeding the oceans. But what seems clear to me right now is that there's no technology that either is capable or has the promise of addressing the most fundamental issue of rising carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. The only solution that strikes me as realistic to addressing climate change is to reduce the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which almost certainly means pushing less up into the atmosphere, right? We don't know how to capture the carbon in an effective way. And we do know how to put less into the atmosphere. We just have been unwilling to do what we need to do in that dimension. And I'm going to leave the Pakistani question, if I may, because I don't know enough about it, first of all, and secondly, I already probably insulted both Pakistan and India by this point.
We're going to go up to the balcony in mic three.
I just have a question about Maine in general and how you feel that Maine will be helpful with our water supply to a global level in the future.
I don't know much about Maine in particular, but I do know that places with lots of water are going to have some power. Canada is a place with lots of water, at least most of Canada. Canada feels that as a threat from the U.S., because Canada's, in economic terms, small, and the United States is big. So there's always this constant worry in Canada of resources being taken. It wouldn't surprise me if Maine has some of that same feeling of, well, those greedy folks to the south are going to take our goodies. Colorado feels that way about California. They might be right. So there's an allocation issue, and it's, you know, within the United States, where the federal government has lots of authority, it's not at all clear that the states with water, which are not always the most powerful states, are going to be able to make the rules. They'll have some extra power, but it may end up being that the federal government or the economics of it or some other force means that the water will be used. Imagine, think of it this way, if the price of water goes up and the users in Maine are not the most able to pay, it's not going to be here. It's going to be somewhere else.
Yeah. Right here, Mike One.
Daniel Dibner from Rockport, Maine. MIT, I apologize before I begin. Over the last 100 years, according to the seminal work that was produced in 1997, unfortunately, by an MITer, it proved beyond a shadow of a doubt through the establishment of a new mean measurement for water level that the last 100 years, the oceans rised 1.8 millimeters. That's 0.1 inch. So during the last 100 years, during the epic increase in temperature as projected, 1.8 millimeter rise in ocean level. How do you project those rises given 100 years of established ocean fact?
So I don't want to fight with you about what one study said in 1997. And I'm not coming up with these estimates. I'm relying on estimates from the IPCC, from climate scientists who are writing on this in a variety of peer-reviewed publications. My attempt here is to not overstate these things. The worst thing that can happen from my purposes is to be perceived as hyperbolic, which is, I guess, the charge you're leveling. And so my defense has been to bias things against that. That is, when I look to the scientific literature, I try to come up with what seems like a consensus, which is always a range, and I try to pick something towards the bottom of that, not at the bottom, but towards the bottom of that range. And that's true for the IPCC measurements over the next 100 years. We have a pretty good idea where the water is. That is, we know that there's going to be some thermal expansion from heat that's going to cause a fairly modest rise. We have an idea that there's going to be water coming from the glaciers into the ocean. That too is going to be fairly modest rise. The action at the end of the day is in Antarctica. How much of the ice that is not current, so there's ice already on the water, in the water in Antarctica, that ice is already factored in, that the sea is however high it's going to be. If that ice melts, it won't change the level, just as an ice cube in a glass does not change the level of your glass water when it melts. The question is, how much of the ice on land in mostly Antarctica, to some extent Greenland and the Arctic, is going to find its way into the oceans, either as water or ice, over the relevant horizon? The understanding of the geography of those massive ice sheets, and there's a huge amount of water there, by the way. If it all went in, which nobody thinks is going to happen, it would be dozens of meters of sea rise. The way in which those things melt or pieces calf off or break off is not very well understood by the folks who study this. I certainly don't pretend to have any specialized understanding of it. But that's where all the action is. So when you see varying estimates of how much the seas will rise, it all boils down to how much you think ice from Antarctica in particular is going to find its way into the ocean. So to the extent we have a disagreement, it's there. And my reading of the literature is that a 1 meter rise in this century is a realistic and non-exaggerated estimate.
Down front, we have Anne with mic two.
Thank you. When you were listing all of the river basins to get to your 3.5 billion, I think all of them were in developing countries.
Include China, yeah, I think that's right.
So my question is, can you talk us through how the climate change water nexus happens? You've mentioned the U.S. to some extent, but other rich countries, because I think part of the issue for many people is that those people who are going to be affected don't live here.
Right. So you're absolutely right. That's the California portion, but it's true in Europe, The Alps have the same dynamic. There's just not as many people, and so if I wanted to get lots of, but you're absolutely right. And so the water, the glaciers, they don't care how rich you are. They're going to melt in the same way based on the climate in which they exist. The consequences will differ, obviously. In California, we will suffer from water shortages and drought. We will have political fights, as we mentioned. It'll have some economic impact. But it's not particularly likely that we'll see famine in California in the next 50 years as a result of this, partly because we'll be able to buy the food that's being made in the rest of the world. California produces a lot of food, though. And if Californian agriculture contracts in terms of output, it's all one market, roughly speaking. And so prices go up everywhere. So rich countries will be affected in terms of agriculture because their production will contract, which will drive up prices for everybody, including themselves. Their politics will be affected. And then obviously all the other things we do with water will be affected, though mostly through price, I suspect.
We have a question from one of our satellite venues. Let's see what that is. Is desalination a possible solution, especially along the coasts?
Oh, thank you for that. I forgot the desalination portion. So the answer is, this again is, surely the answer is yes, in the sense that when prices go up, supply increases. Right now, desalinization is used, but fairly sparingly. And if you look in the Middle East, or in particular in Israel, this is clear. That is, the water crisis in that region is very, very acute, and desalinization is used. But it's not used enough to really address the problem, because it's not efficient enough or too expensive. If the value of water goes up, then the attractiveness of desalinization will increase. It seems unlikely, and I'm no expert on desalinization, but my understanding is it's unlikely that the technology is going to allow us to fully offset or even largely offset the water shortage, which is one of the reasons it's not being used now. But it too, there will be these sort of adaptations in response to moving prices or moving quantities. Desalinization will be one. I gave a talk some time ago, somebody spoke to me afterwards, was an investment banker, said he had a client who was looking for money for a desalinization technology that would make it extremely affordable to the point where it could be used today at current prices. If he's right, we're in great shape. Like, that's awesome. I would invest without knowing a lot more. So there's sort of the current state of desalinization, I don't think is a large-scale solution. Technological progress is always possible. My only caution is that sort of faith-based strategies are not my favorite. So if we just say, well, let's just stand outside the lab until they tell us how to save our planet, right? I don't like that strategy. I want the scientists to do the work, and I desperately want us to know what they're doing and what they're able to do. But I don't like the idea of having no actual policy solution other than waiting and hoping for the scientific miracle.
We're going to go up to the balcony and mic three.
Hi. I understand that the American military has begun looking at the military ramifications of climate change. Could you comment on the kinds of things that have been discussed and could you even speculate as to whether those kinds of discussions might filter into the mainstream political debate?
Well, the military is a leader in this, in the sense that the U.S. military, at least, I assume this is true of other militaries, they're not interested in the political kabuki theater of whether or not climate change is real. They're interested in military concerns, security concerns. Mm-hmm. So they've been studying climate change for a while, and they don't talk about whether it's real or not. They talk about what will it do in this part of the world, what will it do in that part of the world, what are the capacities we need to respond. So one of the things for, so they're terrific, by the way, as sources of information, because they put out reports. Obviously, they have confidential stuff. Who knows what's in those? But they put out reports that are really carefully done about the geopolitics of this, because they're intensely interested in it. But for example, one of the things that's happened, which is not entirely about climate change at all, but there's been a much bigger focus on Africa in the last however many, certainly from the start of the George W. Bush presidency and somewhat before as well. There's been a new focus there. There's been a regional command put in Africa, which previously didn't exist. That's not only because of climate change, because Africa's more important for terrorist concerns about terrorism, because civil unrest in African countries, which used to not be a big concern of the United States, now is a big concern. So the security response is not all about climate change, but part of it is a recognition that Africa is going to really be badly hit by climate change, and that this kind of civil unrest, you can think of it as breeding grounds for terrorism, though it's not really only that, it's also our supply of oil and other things, that Africa is an area of vital security interest to the United States, and it's going to be badly affected. So the US response has included more engagement with Africa, more military presence there, in, not in the literally boots on the ground, though there's a little, you know, but more possibility to respond to crises in Africa.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to stop there. I know there were a couple more questions, but Andrew will be around and you can seek him out.
Thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
We've been listening to a presentation by Andrew Guzman entitled Overheating, the Human Cost of Climate Change, given at the 2014 Camden Conference. If you'd like more information on the Camden Conference, please go to www.camdenconference.org. If you'd like to listen to this program again, or to any of the other programs from the current or past Camden Conferences that were broadcast on WERU, go to www.weru.org and click on the Public Affairs Audio Archives link on the homepage and then on the Camden Conference link. Thanks for listening to this presentation from the 2014 Camden Conference.